It's Friday, February 16th, 2018. Let the record reflect the time is 3:32 p.m. Committee members present, Senator Bishop, Senator Coghill, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Meyer, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused today are Senators Stedman and Willikowski. Thanks to Ann and Max who are helping us out. Today we have two items on our agenda. First, we're going to take up Senate Bill 173 from Senator Machicki related to utility poles. And then we're going to take up Senate Bill 92, also from Senator Machicki, related to derelict vessels. So, Senate Bill 173, Senator Machicki, if you would like to come forward. The bill was initially heard on Monday, at which time public testimony was opened and closed. The bill was again heard on Wednesday, and the committee adopted a committee substitute and had initial discussion. Amendments were set for 5 p.m. yesterday, and none were submitted. So we are now at final discussion. We do have some legal questions, and consequently we have two attorneys on the line. Senator Machicki, did you want to make any kind of opening remarks?
Please, Madam Chair. We had some healthy discussion the other day, and I talked to several of you on the issue. I wanted to make sure that Alaskans were protected from negligence and gross negligence. They were great questions. This bill is only designed to remove strict liability for a very specific reason, but just other law still covers that you're liable for regular liability, public nuisance, nuisance, trespass, negligence, and gross negligence. And we have two attorneys online, one of course being with the state, one being with ATA, that can sort of explain it more legalistically if you choose.
Very good, and I do choose. So the question is what liability will be held by the utilities. So first I'm going to turn to Eric Felsted. Mr. Felsted, you understand the question. We're asking what liability remains with the utilities. Are they completely absolved? So if you'd put your name and affiliation on the record and help us answer that question.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Giesel. My name is Eric Felsted. I'm an attorney with Perkins Coie in Anchorage, and here on behalf of Homer Electric Association. So the question of what liability remains is the liability other than what we call 822. So this section only modifies the strict liability scheme in 4603822. That's sometimes called the state superfund law. All the other statutes and regulations that would applied to this situation continue to be enforced. And, you know, in all candor, there was discussion at the outset as should everything be changed, should there be an attempt to try to change all applicable laws, and the answer was no. This just modifies one law, which is the strict liability scheme. Common law, nuisance, trespass, all of those things are still in play.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Felsted? Sure. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. So maybe for the 822 question, it's pretty clear that it's for the pesticide issue. So if there's a contamination that has some effect on somebody's groundwater, what we're saying is there is no liability issue there. Is that true?
What we're saying is that this particular statute could not be used to recover costs or require cleanup. But what we're not saying is there's a full panoply of other authorities that DEC and others can avail themselves of that would apply. There's water quality standards. There's various other statutory provisions in Title 46. So those are still in effect and not changed at all by this legislation.
Senator Coghill. Yes.
And the question I'm trying to get to is, if there's use of this pesticide, period, there's no liability. True?
There's no liability under this statute. No, it's not true that there's no liability, period. There's no liability using this statute to require cleanup costs for under the statute. But let me just back up a step to kind of focus on kind of two points. You know, one is, what really is the intent of this? These poles use pesticides that are approved by EPA and applied, And when the pesticide is applied in accordance with the EPA, and that's a key point, EPA has made a policy decision that that is appropriate. So that's the starting place. And so a poll with a pesticide applied in this way, it could, you know, it's not uncommon that you're going to have a little area of contamination in the ground around the pole. And so what this is focused on is the question is, you know, the policy question is it appropriate to require a utility to have to clean up, so to speak, that zone of impact, which, you know, might be 18 inches out. And I think what you heard in testimony is that's not inexpensive. It can be up to $30,000 a pole. Because you're hiring a contractor, you're evaluating it, you're digging it out, and then, you know, you're having to literally dispose of that in Washington State. So the policy question is it appropriate to require that as a matter of course? This hasn't come up. The question was raised, well, why hasn't this come up? That's the answer to that is positive. These polls have not been significant issues. There aren't examples of the type we're talking about where a utility pole causes groundwater contamination or it's showing up in someone's well. That's not actually the situation. What is the concern is, you know, the minor amounts of contamination and just having to kind of pole by pole go through and address this. So that's really the focus of this. For the kind of worst case scenarios that have been referenced, there are other tools in DEC's toolbox. Those tools are still on the table. We have not tried to change the way all the other standards would apply.
Thank you.
Further questions? So, Mr. Felsted, I'm putting this really in a simple term, how I think I'm understanding it. What you're saying is that the small amount of I'm going to call it leaching of pesticide around the pole site, you cited 18 inches, doesn't create a Superfund site. Is that too simple to think about? Or
no, that's a good way to put it. It doesn't. And what's reflected here is a matter of policy that the Superfund law we have, call it that, 822, shouldn't be used to require cleanup of that situation.
Very good. Any other questions for Mr. Felsted? Yes, Senator Bishop.
I have one, and I want to get it on the record because we have we have some other contaminated wells in Fairbanks. I just want to be perfectly clear. I heard what you said, and that this is only affecting one section of law, and it doesn't limit the liability on those other sections of law in DEC's toolbox. And I'll get right to the point. If by a one in a gozillion chance that a well, a water well on a residence had trace elements of this in it or measurable elements, would those people still have some recourse?
As mentioned, the other tools in the toolbox are there, and then there's common law, nuisance, trespass, et cetera, but DEC absolutely has recourse. I think citizens probably would have recourse under common law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Felsted. Now, also online with us is Emily Nauman, who, of course, wrote the bill. And Ms. Nauman, you've heard what Mr. Felsted said, how he summarized it. Would you agree with how he described the liability provisions in the bill?
For the record, this is Emily Nauman. I'm with Legislative Legal. To Senator Giesel, yes, I do agree.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Nauman? All right, not seeing any. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Nauman. I know you are very busy over there. We also have Kristen Ryan, and she is on the line for questions as well. Any questions for DEC, Division of Spill Prevention and Response Director? Senator Coghill.
We might just get on the record. What other tools in the toolbox outside of the Superfund site would a liability follow under these pole conditions?
Ms. Ryan, did you hear the question?
I believe so, Madam Chairman. For the record, Kristen Ryan, Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. this legislation would say that the utility pole company is not liable for contamination leaching from the pole, is how we're understanding it. But yes, Mr. Felstead is correct in the fact that there are other authorities we could utilize as nuisance laws, but they aren't, but to be honest, I mean, they aren't as direct. I mean, this is the intent of this legislation is to say they are not liable. So it would be, I feel, a little difficult of a case to make to say they are liable when the law, if the law is changed to explicitly say they're not. So that's, that would be my response.
Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Ryan?
No, I think that's
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that was one of the questions that we struggled with is it, so the Superfund is like a sledgehammer to put a pin in to hang a picture on, you know, in many ways. And so what's the middle ground here if there is found to be a liability somewhere? What would you do under this circumstance, or what would you recommend a tiered liability, or how have you guys seen this, or is this fine with you?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I think the department has shown a process in this situation where we've recognized the situation to be a limited concern. We personally, me personally, but I've directed my staff to not chase this minor amount of contamination from poles if 6 inches are contaminated around the pole. But if we find contamination has leached further or impacted something of more serious nature, it's nice to have this tool in the toolbox to say you did cause damage that needs to be addressed. So I guess I would say that we try to use discretion, regulatory discretion, and only use the hammer, so to speak, when we need the hammer, but try to work with operators with best management practices and other methods when we don't need the hammer. And I feel the department has done so in this situation.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ryan, you have a toxicology report, or it's still outstanding and it won't be back for a couple of 3 weeks. Is that correct?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there's some research being done right now, yes, based on some poles that have been moved down on the Kenai Peninsula through for a road project. The Department of Transportation is assisting with helping us run some tests on how if there's any leaching occurring in wetlands from some of the poles to give us some information. But the goal for that work is to help us draft best management practices. As I've reiterated, this is not something the department wants to take on if there's not a significant threat, and it's almost impossible to imagine there is a significant threat here.
So,
considering these poles are used so regularly all over the world, or at least in the U.S. So that research is ongoing. We hope to have some results. I can't say when, probably by the end of March, we'll have some data to help us provide some guidance to the industry about how to manage the end of life of these utility poles.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, we don't even have any baseline data yet to even say if there's a real problem.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes, we do not. There, I believe there was some data taken on the Kenai Wildlife Refuge that kind of started a lot of this conversation, but that was, as the senator sponsoring the bill has stated, was unscientific. It prompted us to do a little, to see if DOT could help us do a little research, but there is no, you know, significant event at the moment that's triggering concern.
Further questions? So this might be a question for the sponsor, but I'll ask you, Ms. Ryan. So how long has this pesticide been used to treat the poles that are 250,000 of them or whatever are in the state of Alaska? How long have these been in place?
Madam Chairman, I don't know. Penta has definitely been approved for this use. I'm looking right now at the documents from the Environmental Protection Agency to see if they have a date. But it's been around for a very long time and is I did some reading. I know some committee members wanted to know the difference between this and creosote. Creosote is still allowed to be used by the EPA as well, but it sounds like the Environmental Protection Agency encourages this penta product instead for a variety of reasons, one of the main ones being safety of utility workers. Creosote-covered poles are slippery and cause injuries. So that's one reason they aren't recommending their use as much as the penta product, which tends to be a drier inhibitor of growth. But I don't have an exact year, but it's been around, I see, since 2008 at least. That was when they did the last report. They've updated it since then, so for many, many, many years, and it is used all over the U.S., yes.
Great, thank you. And are you the agency that, I don't want to say licenses, but approves on-site water wells for homes and then tests water? Or is it DNR?
DNR gives water use rights. The Department of Environmental Conservation tests and approves public water systems, which are basically 25 people or more. So wells under that threshold are not regulated by DEC.
Okay. And has PENTA shown up in any of the water testing that DEC has done for these wells?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Ryan? Senator Machicki, any continued comments?
No, Madam Chair, I wouldn't have brought this poll forward if it wasn't about a calculation of risk. The calculation of risk is, I believe there are tens of millions of penta-treated poles throughout the U.S., and we've heard a story of a well in the Northeast that may have had a problem. The reality of it is, all we're doing is changing a level of state liability to the liability under federal law. The EPA, a very environmentally conservative, in some ways overly conservative agency. So I just want to remind people of that. That's what the bill is doing, is it's changing from the fact that the state does not observe the federal law exemption to a state that does observe the federal law exemption under FIFRA.
Thank you. Any other questions for the bill sponsor?
Just a comment.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Only that I think the line of questioning was appropriate, because we need to get on the record that if we're going to exempt from any liability this issue, that there are other recourse issues, and the issue is probably about one page in a 10,000-page book that you might have some modicum of problem with. So I think we needed to get a context around it so that when we do the strict exemption, which looks always glaringly, you know, tough, that there's a good reason to do it.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
I appreciate the discussion. We've been working on it all day, actually since the meeting the other day. I wanted to be able to look my constituents and yours in the eye and say that there is other recourse if there is that minute, nearly non-existent probability that there's ever a transference to a water table that we have to evaluate. There's no question. It's been valuable discussion, and I appreciate it much.
Very good. If no other questions or discussion, it is my intention to move the bill. It goes from here to finance, I believe, as a zero fiscal note. Rules. Thank you. Okay. So, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because of the legal question, I was thinking about asking for a legal referral, but I think we answered it sufficiently. So I would move, Madam Chair, that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 173, Work Order 30-LS-1332 Delta, from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note attached.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill will move from this committee to rules. I will take a brief at ease to sign the documents. Call the committee back on the record. The committee now will take up the second item on the agenda. This is Senate Bill 92. By Senator Machicki. Senate Bill 92 was heard on Wednesday, which was the first hearing of this year, but the third hearing in this committee since it was introduced. At Wednesday's hearing, a committee substitute was adopted and public testimony was concluded. A deadline for amendments was set for 5 p.m. yesterday and none were received. So, Senator Machicki, would you like to make any further comments about the derelict vessel bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peter Machicki, District O, and a proud boat owner of one documented and five registered vessels. Interesting discussions the other day. I just want to remind the committee, if I may, Madam Chair, the bill originally had two pieces. One was identifying ownership and responsibility for a vessel. The other was the financial capacity to deal with an incident. Because of some difficulties that some had, we decided to remove the insurance requirement. But we have more work to do on a cradle-to-grave solution. There's no question about that. What this bill does now, and I can tell a story of a vessel. I have a vessel that's in the sort of Middle Ages, right? It's a 1985. I've owned it for going on 30 years and take very good care of it. When I get to the point of where I'm ready to move on to a new commercial fishing vessel, my vessel will be likely purchased by someone who's a different stage of vessel care and the ability to invest in that vessel. At some point, that vessel could end up in a harbor where I don't know if you've been to some of the harbors around, but the ones you see that where the growth is almost encompassing the other vessels around it, a lot of marine growth, not a lot of maintenance, pumps come on a little less often, eventually start sitting a little lower in the water. Things happen to vessels over time. Even fiberglass vessels have wooden stringers. Through the flexing, you'll find a hole at some point. Water gets into those stringers. You start getting delamination. When it gets to that point, we will now give the tools to a harbor to know who owns that vessel. And they can contact the owner of that vessel and say, we see a problem coming over the next X amount of time. We want you to deal with it. If you don't deal with it, we will pull the vessel out of the water for a fraction of the cost while it's still afloat than we would pulling it off the bottom or out of the channel. That's what this is about. At some point, I'd like to get to where we can prove financial capacity to deal with that problem if that same vessel ends up on the bottom. But that'll be the next stage. This provides valuable tools for the literally thousands of vessels that are lining the beaches and waterways, both fresh and salt water, around the state of Alaska. It's an early way to avoid a much more expensive problem for our municipalities and state.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor? I will also let folks know that Ledge Legal, Linda Bruce, is on the phone if we have any questions about the bill drafting. We also have Marla Thompson and Amy Johnson from DMV. And here in the room is Ed King from the Department of Natural Resources. Heidi Hansen, Deputy Director, is here with us to answer any questions. And the commissioner as well, though he may be handing off to the deputy. In any case, any questions for any of these experts? Senator Coghill.
One of the things that caught my attention that maybe the sponsor can answer or maybe waylay it to the vision. On the forfeiture rule on page 5, line 25, there's a requirement forfeiture. Give me, if you're guilty of a Class A misdemeanor at this point, it looks like you can have a forfeiture. What does that look like as far as the enforcement? Because it looks like probably the value is way over probably the fine of $5,000 because the reclamation might be far and away beyond. So that's an or. But what was the intention of putting the forfeiture in there?
Well, I talked about that briefly. I think the or is because the municipality or state may realize that taking the vessel out of the water is the best option. Hopefully it never results in a misdemeanor or a fine. Hopefully you can arrive at some sort of solution that avoids a vessel being on the bottom. But I believe that you have to give the state the opportunity to act, and that includes up to forfeiture. In many cases, you're going to have an owner that, as we heard some of the stories, and we don't want to get in the way of the dreams of folks. Of course, in this case, all we're doing is requiring titling and registration. But sometimes those dreams are someone that no longer lives in the state. Forfeiture may be the only way to remove that vessel. In other cases, someone just may not be financially capable of even removing the vessel from the water. So in those cases, I believe it delivers some optionality and a little bit of a stick for folks that may be fighting to have the vessel dealt with, if you will.
Follow up, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, once again reiterate that the testimony that we got the other day when this bill was up on the process, the group of people that got together trying to figure out answers to this, was truly impressive, and I think and worthy of great respect. And I think this is, the partial solution coming forward, right? So I just didn't want us to start going down the road of tools that either were going to be more costly for us to do or could be misused. And I don't think they will, but, every time I see forfeiture, it gets my attention. So thank you. Good answer. Once again, I see this has civil penalties and forfeiture and all that. Probably should go to Judiciary Committee, but here we are again. Anyway, So looking over these penalty issues, I appreciate the work that was done into them, but I haven't had a chance to thoroughly vet them, so whatever. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, and of course you bring up the cost involved, and the fiscal note is there for DMV. We don't have one yet from DNR, but we heard at the last testimony that one vessel out in Dutch Harbor, if I'm not mistaken, 250 hours of DNR, Mining Land and Water staff time. That's significant. So if there's any way we can somewhat relieve that, I know Senator McChicky will continue to pursue that. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment to DNR. They don't need to come up to the table, but just a comment. As this historic preservation section, if there's a vessel that is deemed worthy by that division to be preserved, you would honor that?
Thank you. The answer was yes, right?
Yep.
Very good. I stand corrected. Actually, I see three fiscal notes attached to the bill, one from DNR, one from DEC, and one, of course, from DMV, Division of Motor Vehicles. So those three are actually in our packet. I hadn't seen them. Thanks for updating me. All right. No further questions or discussion. Senator Coghill, a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we move from the committee substitute for committee's bill, I think it's our Senate substitute, Senate Bill 92, Work Order 30LS0481, Juliet, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill will move on to the Finance Committee. While the signature document is being passed around, I'll just say this concludes our meeting. Our next hearing will be on Monday. We will hear the first hearing of some of the governor's appointees, two of them to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and one to the State Assessment Review Board. And then we will take up the first hearing on Senate Bill 164. That relates to the confidentiality of testing of livestock and crops, otherwise called HIPAA for horses. And so with that, the meeting stands adjourned. The time is 4:02 p.m.